Hi, this is Larry Windsor from California.
Hi, Larry.
Hello. This is an official person, right?
Larry, not one more acre, right?
One more acre is what
right.
I meant by official.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Great.
Hi, everybody.
And is Jean on the call now?
Yes.
Yes, I am.
Oh, good.
Hi.
Good.
Is what's that?
On the call?
Yep, we are being recorded.
Good. And can you put up any of that, Rich? Can you put up any of that? Did you get?
I've got that.
www.
Virginia just put up the not one more acre thing.
Okay.
I've got the Grasslands Trust for when we start talking about that.
Good.
And I've got that.
We're not organized here, so we don't have chat room up.
Military Veterans Affairs Language Appropriations Act thing.
Okay, who else is, somebody else just pinged? Who else hasn't said their name, please? Hello, is anybody else on here? Hi, would you say your name? Am I muted, Carl?
No.
Okay.
No, I hear you, and there have been a few pings. Anybody else want to tell us who's on the line? No.
Hi.
Go ahead. Oh, I'm Susan Harmon from Oakland.
Hi, Susan.
Hi,
hello.
Susan.
You made it.
Yes.
Who else?
Yes,
CJ.
Hi, CJ. Say your whole name.
CJ Minster from Los Angeles.
Yes. Good. Anyone else?
Sally, this is Sherry. I came on before you did, but I thought I'd let you know I'm on.
Hi, Sherry Long.
Sherry Long, and Rich Gardner, and Clarence from Georgia. Clarence.
All right, who just joined?
This is Dave Keeler in San Diego.
Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi, David.
I'll mute.
All right, well, it's 7:05, and we'd like to, this is Virginia Hoffler, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the call tonight. We have two great speakers, so we want to get right to it. We're going to begin with Jean Aguirre of Not One More Acre, talking about the Pentagon's plans for basically a 51st state devoted totally to warfare. Jean's going to tell us a little bit about what has been going on and the land grabs that have been made by the military and what they have done locally and nationally to try to stop this and what they're doing and how we can help. Jean?
Great, thanks. Thanks very much. I'm really pleased to be here. Who is on from New Mexico, please? Anyone?
Susan Cote.
Okay. Oh, hi, Susan. Hi.
Hi.
Because New Mexico, as everyone will see on the map, is as much a part of this 51st state as is Southern Colorado.
Correct.
So just a brief overview for those of you who haven't had a chance to look at the website or get the background. We found out, I just chronicle it as we know it today, not as we discovered it. Since 1996, the Pentagon has been planning over a 60 million acre takeover of southern Colorado and northern New Mexico for robotic warfare. The planning issued its first document in 1999. None of us knew about it. We didn't find out anything about it until 2006, when in fact, everything had been laid in for the takeover. The Pentagon broke the takeover basically into two pieces, two big pieces that then have lots of little purpose, but two big pieces. One under the guise of the Army, which is the land acquisition, 6.1 million acres, and the other one through the Air Force. But these turn out to be shills, really, because what we find out is that it's basically all special operations, joint forces special operations. It's really important for us all to be aware, I think, that the United States military underwent a dramatic reorganization basically during this time period, 1996 to 2006, when everything was really into place. Its reconfiguration is called transformation. Transformation began with Rumsfeld and Cheney over 30 years ago as a doctrine that foresaw in neocon rationale how to take humans out of harm's way of war. That's the neocon rationale for it. So how to advance robotic warfare. In fact, it became more than a doctrine. As I say, it became a reconfiguration. So battalions became combat brigades on the Army side. On the Air Force side, flight wings became special operations wings. So it advanced so far that they actually started to envision a training area dedicated to robotic warfare, and that is what we see here. Transformation also did another really important and impactful thing. It integrated weapon systems. So when we think of drone warfare now, you know, a lot of us picture a guy in not a remote controlling some kind of machine called a drone. But in fact, it's more complex than that and much more impactful in that the drone is connected to helicopters, as in combat aviation brigades. The drone and the operator are connected to airplane systems, to systems, even to boots on the ground, soldiers who are now lacking handheld drones. And the technology has advanced to the point that now really autonomous drones are in fact being deployed into the field. Autonomous drones mimic insect swarms so that the drones talk with each other and operate autonomously without a human being in Nevada or some remote location. So when we came on to the fact that this was going on, the people in southeastern Colorado sniffed it because they had been condemned in the 1980s to the tune of 250,000 acres. These are large, by and large, generational ranches. By large, I mean ranches 100,000, 160,000 acres large. The fact of the matter is that Gary Hart wanted to run for president. The Army had been pushing for a land expansion out of Colorado from the Army based in Colorado Springs, Fort Carson, had been pushing for a ranch expansion. Tip O'Neill and Congressman from Southern Colorado had held it off, had it really pretty much killed. When Gary wanted to run for president, the Army saw an opportunity. Gary gave the okay, and boom, here came the condemnation. I actually grew up there, and for 4.5 years from day to day, we didn't know if we were going to be condemned. We saw neighbors condemned. Some people fought. Some people just gave up. It was a really nasty period. But this left such a nasty taste in people's minds and hearts about the military. Finally, in 2000, 2006, really sensed that something was going on. And I went home. I was living in Oregon, and we just hit the bricks. We found out that environmental impact statement was going to be issued, blah, blah, blah. I got an attorney. We got not one more acre and grassland trust up. We formed a board. We all got together. The ranchers ready to roll. We did. You'll all love it. As progressive Democrats, we did just a classic grassroots campaign. We started with the county commissioners, got them to vote against it, ran a bill in the state house, passed it. Then we had to get a funding ban in Congress. And I will tell you that it was quite an experience. My first career was in politics, federal campaigns, basically, when I found myself riding the funding ban with a fundamentalist Republican congresswoman. But she, in fact, had children in the military. She knew that the military didn't need more land. She knew that the ranchers had been condemned before, and she stood strongly against it. We ran into a problem then with the Democrat, who was John Salazar. His brother, the Secretary of Interior, had actually authorized the acquisition of real properties behind everyone's back in 2005. So no one knew in Southern Colorado that there was already an authorization for the acquisition property. We did find it. We, long story short, got this legislation written. We really deployed an aggressive field campaign with lots of constituent calls to John Salazar to get him to sign on to the bill. We had the support of Obie. Dave Obie called the whips to the floor, and we passed it overwhelmingly in that first year, which was way back in 2007. So if we all just back up for a minute and remember that, take away all the bells and whistles, Congress really only basically does two things. On the right hand, they authorize or set policy framework, and on the other hand, they appropriate or fund that policy. Here we were in a situation where the policy framework was in place to acquire the land. We came in through the back door with a funding ban on appropriation side in the House. So because the senators are very much Mark Udall, now Michael Bennett, before Ken Salazar and this horrible Republican, Wayne Edward, were supporting the Colorado land acquisition, and still are, they won't authorize the funding ban. So we have to renew this funding ban every single year in the House. I'll watch it as we are now, as it moves through conference committee with only support from the House. So it's a very precarious situation, and I'll tell you, we are so thrilled to be on this call with you all, because there is a lot of presence here with people who can really motivate progressive Democrats in priority states, that we need to have the Congress people on appropriations understand that this is a national issue, that we do not want any spending on this, and that in the new session, we will really have to renew this funding ban one more time. And I am telling you, I'm not exaggerating, that we have worked the last 72 hours hardly with any sleep, because the military is being so aggressive about coming after the land. Now, I don't want to leave. I'm almost finished here. I don't want to leave New Mexico out of the picture. I went home in 2006 when we first started sniffing this, and by February of 2007, we knew that there was an Air Force piece. So on the map, on the website, that's the green part. It's for low altitude navigation, but it's really to define that airspace for air war, for drone war, for drone and its accompanying manned aviation to have their training area there. Now we've got the Air Force, which is really a special Air Force Special Operations out of Camp Air Force Base, which actually was closed but was reopened and repurposed for this expansion. And we have the Army piece on the lease. But all of them have the same toys, right? All of them drones, both the Air Force and the Army. Both of them aviation assets. Both of them have ground assets, even the Air Force. So they're now this Joint Forces Future Combat System area that is in competition with itself, with the entities, each wanting more toys than the other one, each wanting more weapon systems than the one. Dave Obey said to us when he gave us the support for the funding ban, if we let one dime go in this, it will open an endless hemorrhage of taxpayer dollars. That's what he said as chairman of appropriations. That's why he gave us the, you know, called the whips and once we delivered the politics, he called the whips and got the bill passed. So that's the situation we're in. We look like we'll be okay, although it could slip out as these appropriations bills are finishing right now. But come January, we need to return on different constituencies in different states. So we have, I know, Georgia on the phone. Terrence, we really need to be able to contact progressive Dems in Columbus, in Sanford Bishop's district. He's on appropriations. We need progressives to be really out there saying how they want to be represented, and it's not by the national coffers going in to create the Pentagon's 51st state. I think we have Arizona, and of course we do, hosting Ed Pastor out of Phoenix. Absolutely on appropriations. He's not on the subcommittee where our funding ban is, but he's an appropriator. And we need him to know about this. New York, Virginia, Massachusetts, California, of course, with appropriators in the House in all of these places. Oakland is here. Barbara Lee is with us, but we really need more than just have a casual conversations with wonderful Barbara saying, "Oh yes," and with this. We need people actually calling her to say this is important to us. Right? Minnesota. I don't know if we have Minnesota on the phone, but there's a very important member there, Washington State, with Norm Dix. So that's it in a nutshell. I could send, if it's easier for people, send a memo afterwards just detailing the priority districts we have right now, where I think growing the awareness among progressives is critical to the success and critical really to not only saving this place, but preventing endless hemorrhage of dollars being poured into this.
Well, that would be wonderful, Jean, if you would send me the list and we can get together with get all the phone numbers together and send out a blast asking people in those districts to make phone calls. And
okay. May I share just one other thing? Do people have? Are people able to get the website up?
I have it up.
No. Okay. If you click in the right-hand corner of Southeastern Colorado, and you see that expansion, you see the expansion map come up.
In Colorado.
Of the land acquisition.
Yes. Expansion parcel map.
Okay, and now see the PCMS, the logo, the green piece that says PCMS.
PCMS.
Uh-huh. When you click on the right-hand corner, maybe this is not a good use of people's time. But it is, it's an astonishing story. So there is this expansion map. If when you can get to it, you click on that right corner of southeastern Colorado, you'll get the expansion map that is actually their plane map, the military's planning map. You'll see a little land called PCMS. That's the existing site. That's the 38,000 because we took 17,000 acres back away from them. But that's the military land right there, that little PCMS, 250,000 acres. You'll see a piece that says 1A in red. Soon as everything had been arranged secretly behind the back of the people who would be condemned and the public lands that would be taken. These national grasslands are there, their recovery units from the Dust Bowl, their environmental miracles, really. As soon as all of that was laid in, a military contractor banker, a private military contractor who also owns 7 banks in Colorado, and a Texas oil and gas man who had bought off some Texas politicians in part of this whole ploy, came in and bought that ranch directly south of the military land. And their plan was to flip that military so the condemnations would begin. This is how powerful the funding ban is and how fragile in the same moment. If we let that funding ban slip for 1 second, those guys are sitting there to flip and use our tax dollars to start the takeover, the land takeover. The New Mexico-Colorado air piece is also very precarious. We just came through an EA environmental assessment. They're going to be announcing, I guess, in January that they're backing off, but they won't be backing off. I mean, they'll just tell us that. So we'll press for a funding ban against the Air Force piece, too, the low altitude navigation. But so that's where we are. That's where we are. I think everyone on the phone is dedicated to converting this economy that is now 56% of the American spending goes in the military, quote-unquote, intelligence complex, 56%. Military contractors are the number one driver of the U.S. economy right now. Mm-hmm. So we not only need to continue to stop spending that shouldn't happen, as with the funding ban, of course, but then I hope that all of us can carry our work forward and reconvert or create a new economy. So we've just begun together.
Well,
I got to work.
Dean, we're running a little bit late, but we'll take a few questions. Is there somebody that has a question for Dean?
Yes, this is Sherry Long. One of the best ways that I know to get messages across is via Facebook. Do you all have any kind of a presence on any of the social medias?
We have avoided it directly, Sherry, just because of some problems we've had that are not of our own making. But I will tell you that year when we almost lost the funding ban, Facebook saved us. We went out to its supporters like New York, Connecticut, California, and we asked our supporters in those areas to Facebook the fact that we did calls to their Congress people who were appropriators, and I'm telling you, it worked beautifully. So you're right. I think while we don't have Facebook particularly, we do try to know who has Facebook, and we go out and ask people to motive through Facebook.
Well, PDA is great on Facebook, so don't forget to use that.
Okay, great. Good to know.
Okay, any more questions? Well, if there's no more questions, one more thing I would like you to do, Gene, and if you could just read the bands so they can see just how basic and simple it is. So, and it's easy to talk to your congressmen and tell them, you know, just it's one sentence, easy to understand. There's no reason they can't look at you and say, yes, I can vote for that or not.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. I don't know if I actually have it in front. Oh, here I do. Yeah, sorry. Do you have? Maybe you should read it. I don't have it in front of me. I lost it.
Okay, I don't have it in front of me.
Here it is. I've got it. Here it is. None of the funds available by this act may be used for any action, that relates to or promotes the expansion of the boundaries or size of the Pinyon Canyon Maneuver Site, Colorado. So any action. Now, of course, they're really tripping all over that, but they have not been able to get land acquisition with that.
Okay, where is that on your website?
I think it is on the Achievements tab. I think yes. And also, I'll include in the memo I send around my contact, you know, we'll love to hear any guidance anyone has for us. We have only gotten where we have because we are truly a grassroots campaign who people bring great ideas, and it's the winning factor. So thanks very, very much for giving me time and being able to meet with you.
Thank you, Jean. And if they use that contact tab on your website, who answers that? Do you answer that? Does Larry answer that? I think Larry Windsor answers
that. Yeah, we have a couple of people watching it, but if it's addressed to me, get it to me right away. And I also pick that up as much as anybody else does. I also want everybody to know for sure that Larry Windsor, who I think was with you last month, is also on today. Larry and I go way back to the McGovern campaign together. We were teenagers on the national camp together and
Jean
have been close friends ever since. And Larry's a great and invaluable asset to Not One More Acre and to Democrats everywhere.
My name is Dolores Preem, and I'm just entering from San Francisco. I'm sorry I'm late.
Okay. Hi, Dolores. Thank you very much, Jean. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, I have an announcement to make regarding Progressive Democrats and the War Issue Organizing Team. Tom Hayden has agreed to be the lead PDA person on policy research and advocacy on ending the U.S. wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. He'll be calling for the savings to be reinvested in American domestic priorities and defending civil liberties against the national security state. This role will include policy on drone wars and the Assange, Manning, WikiLeaks prosecutions. So we really appreciate that Tom Hayden has stepped up and is going to be the lead person for PDA. So for all of you who know him or are on his website regularly, you know, please thank him for coming on and helping us out here. So our next speaker is Rusty Eisenberg. Rusty is a professor of U.S. foreign policy at Hofstra University. She's presently completing a book, which, among other things, looks at the role of Congress in ending the Vietnam War. Rusty's with the UFPJ, United for Peace and Justice. She's regularly has her own weekly calls, I believe, and is just a great source of information for me. Rusty?
Yeah, hi, can you hear me? Is that my
yeah,
voice coming through? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Right, I should add my co-convener for UFPJ is Gail Murphy, who is an indefatigable worker together on this. But thank you very much for inviting me on the call. And, you know, it's been just phenomenal to be able to really work with PDA on, you know, on so many things. I thought I would try to just start by noting something positive, which may change the tenor of things, which is that the Iraq war is ending. And, you know, it's kind of, I mean, I think all of us have such complicated feelings about it, and we know how big the embassy is, and we know that there are going to be defense contractors, and we know they're going to put people in Kuwait. So, and we also know of the tremendous, you know, suffering that has gone on in that country, so it's very hard for any thoughtful person, you know, to be jumping up and down. But the fact is this war is coming to an end, and our troops are coming home, and I think we need to really take note of that and also to take some ownership of that. I think it would not have happened without the peace movement. We're not the only reason why it's happened, but we're an important part. And I also think it's important to recognize that the legislative work that was done on Iraq was also very important in producing that result. You know, 'cause I think it's very difficult to keep going on with this when you just feel everything you do fails. And I think sometimes people kind of miss the fact that this legislative work actually was helpful. And the reason I think often people miss it is that, you know, we never ever really passed anything that defunded the war, and even the, you know, strong anti-war amendments never quite passed. And so, you know, some folks look at that and they say, well, you know, you didn't get anywhere. And, you know, in some ways, as a historian, I think that rests on a sort of fallacious, actually a myth of Vietnam. And the myth of Vietnam is that somehow there was this day where Congress cut off the money and then the war had to end. And that's actually a misunderstanding of what happened, because Congress didn't cut off the money till all the U.S. troops were out of Vietnam. But what Congress did do Vietnam, and it was very, very important, is that it had many, many, many votes on all kinds of pieces of legislation in one way or another, you know, aiming to rein in the war, stop the war, limit the war. And these pieces of legislation were stronger and stronger, more and more people supported them. And it created an atmosphere in which it became very difficult, especially for the Nixon administration, to just keep continuing to accelerate. And so, you know, even though things didn't really pass until after the peace treaty was signed, Congress really played a very, very important role. And I'm saying that apart from just being a historian and always having to say these things, because I think we need to understand that that was also the case with Iraq, that even though we never got, quote, a legislative victory, that these repeated fights that we had in Congress and the lobby days and the call-in days and the emails that you could often feel very discouraged about really helped to create a very important atmosphere. It affected the presidential campaign. Ultimately, Obama had to even explain why he voted no on some more spending. It created a context in which President Bush was negotiating the status of forces agreement with the Iraqis. He really was in a very, very weak position to resist what they were saying, and ultimately made concessions, which have led to the result we have today. So, again, I don't think we should try to claim all the credit for it, certainly, but I do think that the legislative work contributed, and I think it's important to see that as we go forward, because we do have a lot of setbacks, but that we don't have to win a vote, but we need to have significant votes on significant bills and to be as loud a voice as we possibly can. So with that, by way of background, I want to just turn to, like, what's going on this minute. So it's weird, but I can't see anybody. I'm used to classes of actual people. So I'm hoping I'm not talking too fast. But, I mean, obviously the thing that's on everybody's mind right now is the National Defense Authorization Act, which is before Congress at this very moment. It's a complicated bill. I want to say two very quick things. The House is expected to vote on that bill tomorrow, and the Senate on the day after. So this is all really very imminent. Each House of Congress has already voted on a version of the bill, and then it went to conference this past weekend, and it was only this morning that the conference report came out, so people are still poring over that, and I don't pretend to be knowledgeable about all the details. But I think a couple things should be said. There was change in the language on the detainees, mostly to give the president a little bit more flexibility that he wanted. But what's not really changed is the legislative endorsement of indefinite detention of people who are suspected of terrorism, who could be held forever without charges and without, you know, a trial. And that's still in there. Now, the question I've been looking all day frantically, knowing I was going to be on this call, to see about the issue of the what the implication is for American citizens. And actually, as I'm reading it, there's still conflicting opinion about how this what this latest version means in terms of U.S. citizens. And I'm not a lawyer, so I don't feel able to say definitively. And if you read the highlights of the report, they're at pains, I'm saying the highlights of the conference committee, they're at pains to say that, you know, that this doesn't affect U.S. civilians. But then there's fine print. It doesn't affect U.S. citizens. But there is fine print there. So there's actually disagreement among civil liberty people right now about what the implication is for our citizens. But there's no disagreement on the fact that this is terrible and that this has the Congress essentially endorsing policies that are absolutely abhorrent, you know, to our own Constitution, to our traditions, et cetera. That is that, again, you know, the Congress is on record as just endorsing the idea that you can accuse somebody of being a terrorist and you can just lock them up and with no obligation to do anything. It also makes it very difficult, actually impossible, to bring anybody from Guantanamo to the United States. It severely limits even sending people from Guantanamo to their own countries or to third countries. I mean, those provisions are still very problematic. The other thing I really want to flag for people, because it's easy to miss it, and I almost did, is a lot of us felt very good about a week ago about the Merkley Amendment that passed the Senate, and that had loopholes in it, but it basically put the Senate on record as saying that the president needed a plan to get out of Afghanistan before 2014. So that seemed like a good thing. That language has disappeared, and if people are out there on the phone, I want to really repeat that because it's gone. The Merkley language has gone from that bill. It's been turned into something else, which is an accelerated plan to help the Afghan forces become more effective in security. So that's quite an alteration of what the of what the amendment really said. And thanks to Steve Miles from Room Without War, who really got on top of that. So Merkley is basically gone. There are also, you know, new sanctions on Iran in terms of the restrictions on its central bank. I mean, there's a lot wrong with it, but the biggest thing that's wrong with it is it not only that it continues the war in Afghanistan, but it is a huge amount of money that is still going to the military at the moment that we don't have the money, you know, here at home to do the things that we all need necessary. So what is the sum up? We should oppose this, and we should oppose it as strongly as we, you know, as we can. We ought to try. We have very little moment to do this, but I think tomorrow we all need to put out alerts asking people to call their senators and their representatives, because it's coming back to the House as well as the Senate, and push very hard for a no vote. So that's kind of simple. Sally, give me a heads up because I'm talking into the air, and how much time do I have, because I don't want to overstep. Can somebody give me a time? Okay, well, let me keep going, but somebody should, you know, demute.
Okay. 5 minutes, and then we'll take some questions.
Okay. Let me just, so again, I think what, you know, what's to be done? Well, the immediate, very immediate thing is we ought to try to get as large a vote against that bill as we possibly can. One deeper point I'd like to address, which is that we have really been behind the ball on trying to build sentiment for a no vote on this defense authorization bill. I mean, this bill has been bouncing around for months, and the reality is that the peace movement in general has been quite silent about the need to defeat this bill or to get as many members of Congress as possible to oppose this bill. There's been, if you think about it, there's been very, very little discussion of that. And, you know, in a way, it parallels the situation we had this past summer when the Congress was voting on the defense appropriations bill. And there as well, the peace movement was very, very slow to really, you know, talk about the need to have a no vote. I have to, you know, say that PDA is exempt from that, that PDA was very, you know, proactive around that. But in general, there's been very little organization around the need to say no to these bills. And if we ask ourselves, why is that the case? Why has there been such a crashing silence about it? I think the short answer to that is that peace groups around the country, national peace groups, especially those with a presence on Capitol Hill, have tended to emphasize these amendments. You know, and this most recently, the Merkley Amendment, in the summer it was the McGovern Amendment. And so a lot of energy has gone into that. You know, I'm sure many of you received probably 12 different alerts about the Merkley Amendment, which has now, you know, gone to oblivion. And, you know, there's obvious reasons for that. You can do a lot better on those kinds of amendments. You can make a little bit of an impact. It's much harder, you know, to get people to, you know, to vote no on a defense appropriations bill or an authorization bill. You know, we've had this argument that's gone on for years in the peace movement about do you push the amendment or, you know, or do you talk about the bill as a whole and which is better? And often people, you know, can get very harsh with one another about it. And my own view about this is that you do both, you know, that but it's really important to do both. I think the fight to get these amendments is a good thing. And I think it's good that the Merkley thing passed because it is a sign to the White House about the way things are moving, you know, even if it's now disappeared. I think it's very good that the McGovern Amendment got as many votes as it did. I think these are really positive things. But I think it would have been better if, at the same time as folks were pushing for that, they also kept their eye on the ball and that we, you know, continue to say that this vast pots of money that are going to the Pentagon are really bad, and not that they're just abstractly bad. I mean, everybody in the world talks about defense in the abstract, but that the expenditures happen because specific bills get passed, which then, you know, make it possible to have all this money go in one direction rather than another. And I think we've really been very lackadaisical, you know, on that, you know, on that particular side. I also think that there's another problem, and maybe this will segue into a very important discussion about the occupation movement and how it connects, which is that it's always a fine line for us because on the one hand, when you do legislative work, you want to be in support of things that are relevant on Capitol Hill that our allies will support, that will make some kind of an impact. That's one task. On the other side, we also need to be doing things that make sense to our own base, to the grassroots, so that people feel excited and energized about it. And sometimes those things are kind of in conflict. You know, so, for example, I think that the Merkley Amendment is an example of that. It was a good amendment. It was good to support it. But the truth of the matter is that unless you are really already, like, very involved in legislative work, you're a random person who wants peace, a Merkley Amendment doesn't really resonate. So it's very hard to get a lot of fresh energy around it. So I think we always have to kind of look for ways to do those two things. So where do we go from here? Well, again, I think we should try to get as many votes in the next 2 days as we can that are negative. A second thing that, you know, we don't want to lose sight of and will become even more relevant in January is the continuing valiant efforts of Barbara Lee to get a lot of congressional support for getting out of Afghanistan now rather than 3 years from now. She's still got her bill, H.R. 780. It has, I think, right now 64 co-sponsors. The truth is that if a lot of us worked on that and really put some energy into it, we could double that amount of people going into January. And again, is that enough to stop the war? No, but the truth is if we can get that many folks on Barbara Lee's bill and really work on that, it really will help move the whole debate in the country, and I think it's really worth doing. One other item I want to mention, because it's very confused, is the 2012 Defense Appropriations Bill. A version of that has passed the House. It actually has not passed the Senate. So that's still hanging. However, and this is so confusing, I'm hoping that people know what I'm talking about. It's hanging fire, but what seems like might be happening is that the Defense Appropriations Bill – may be getting folded into an omnibus spending bill for 2012, which would cover many, many areas. And if it did that, it would be very difficult for us in the peace movement to oppose it, because you don't want to just stop the whole government. We don't know that. If it turn, but that may be happening right now. If it doesn't happen, if it's not folded in, then I think it's really important that we put some energy into that, into really trying to build up some grassroots opposition to that bill. But going forward, and I don't have any brilliant ideas on this, but I think we all need to be thinking about this. I think the occupation movement changes to some extent the context of our work. You know, even recognizing that in many places, and that's true in New York, there's a reluctance by the occupation movements to get involved in specific legislation. Nevertheless, they're creating a new mood in the country. And I think we need to take account of that in our congressional work. And I think it's relevant in two ways. I think, you know, going forward into the new year, I think we need to figure out ways to formulate our demands on the defense building for, bill for 2013 and going forward, formulating it in a way that is simple and clear and makes a lot of sense to lots of people. And we have to figure out a way to do that. And secondly, I actually think we need all of us to do new tactics, that some of the direct action that the occupation folks have been doing around the country has really been very, very energizing. And I think we all, and I include USPJ in this, and I mean, again, PD Day has done an amazing job with the vigils, but we need to way to look for ways to step up what we do, the direct action piece of it, so that people really focus on the fact that their elected representatives keep going out and spending billions and billions of dollars on this wasteful stuff while claiming that there's no money to do these other things. So I think we need to really sort of revisit things that we visited before and look for new opportunities. So I'm actually going to stop here. You know, happy to take questions and happy for anybody else's good ideas, because really, you know, we all need to strategize together.
Well, you're right. It is certainly time for all of us to get on the phone and make some more phone calls against this bill. That's for sure. Tomorrow. Do we have any more questions for Rusty?
Well, this Ina, I just want to clear. I mean, confirm that, you know, we're working in. So there are two appropriations bills for there were two appropriations committees for defense, military construction and DOD, and we work on the military construction side of it. That's where our funding ban is parked. But we watch DOD very carefully, because that would be where we take the longitude navigation funding ban for the 51st state. But it's our understanding, too, that DOD bill is probably going to be rolled into all of the appropriations bills. So thank you for your clarification about that and advice about when we hold them and when we can oppose bill.
CJ Stack.
Chuck Stack.
Who's next? CJ? I wanted to point out Congressional Quarterly this morning reported that negotiators reached agreement last night and filed their conference report this morning on the defense authorization bill. So it is actually going forward as separate from the omnibus spending bill. And they worked with the president on it. It's still crappy language, but it's apparently the language on indefinite detention won't be vetoed by the president, and it still has a clause about tough sanctions on the Iranian central bank as well.
Hi, CJ. Let me clarify, because there are two different things that are getting pushed together, and they're not the same. One is the 2012 defense authorization bill. Okay, that's the authorization. The other is the 2012 appropriations bill. The thing, CJ, that you're talking about is the authorization bill, and that is not rolled into anything, and it's going to be voted on tomorrow probably in the House and Thursday in the Senate. The thing that is getting rolled is the defense appropriation, which actually passed the House this summer. And it's the appropriation that may very well be rolled into an omnibus bill. So those are two different things. But we absolutely should be acting right now on the authorization bill. So thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Stack.
Okay. Go ahead.
I had a question about the Garamendi Amendment this past summer. My congressman won't vote for Barbara Lee's bill, but he voted for the Garamendi Amendment. Is there any talk of a more moderate withdrawal bill?
More moderate than Barbara Lee's, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Barbara Lee's is basically, let's get the heck out of there. And there are other shades of gray Congress could go for.
Well, the Garamendi Amendment was, was an amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill. Barbara Lee's Bill 780, I always want to reverse that in my mind. I keep switching the number. But Barbara Lee's bill right now is a standalone bill. It's not attached at present to the appropriations bill. So is it possible that other people could introduce standalone bills that would be more moderate? I suspect so. I actually have is a kind of conversation that tends to go on with folks who have offices on Capitol Hill and are talking to staff members. And so it's possible McGovern would come forward with something in January that's more moderate. So I can't answer yes or no that this is going to happen. It might happen. But I think there is a kind of an issue for all of us, and it's really a dilemma a lot of the time, about you have these different options. And, do you go for the stronger bill or do you go for the weaker bill? And again, it's not always possible to do this, but my own view, and I think this has been the experience of UFPJ, over many years, is that we do best when we really support each other and that we put our sort of voices and strengths behind initiatives that move in the direction of peace and try to do both rather than pit them against each other. So I feel like that's a good, again, sometimes you just can't do that. Sometimes you just literally have to choose. But I think often we really don't have to. And, in terms of maximizing our strength, I think it's good to have a kind of broad, willingness to use broad approaches.
Terrence Stack.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Tom.
I was just calling. First of all, I just want to thank both presenters for that really great update as far as what's going on out there. And, ma'am, I thank you for your scholarship. And I just also wanted to ask, because you did bring up the Occupy Wall Street folks, and what I was wondering is, do you think that if we were to use a tool like the People's Budget to go to the, younger, activists and get them to understand that there is a correlation between or a relationship between, the defense spending and their quality of life and what they could have?
Well, I think a couple of things, and there may be folks on this call that actually know a lot more than I do about this, because I saw that as of just this morning, right, that the Progressive Caucus has actually, introduced a new bill, which is very comprehensive, which is combining, it's taking the people's budget and it's making it more explicit on certain things, and it's turning it into a comprehensive piece of legislation. And I've looked at it for about 5 minutes today, so almost anybody would be more expert. But that would be probably the latest iteration of that. I'm honestly not sure about it. I mean, I feel like, you know, the upside is that what the Progressive Caucus is saying and proposing is excellent. The complexity, you know, is that when you're going to these Occupy meetings, you know, sometimes, you know, too elaborate, it, you know, doesn't quite work. So I think, you know, people in a way have to, you know, figure out how they fit with their local meetings. I think there's a lot more work that we should be doing with the Occupy folks, though, in terms of, you know, tying together this defense budget and what it really means for the 99% of Americans who need government to do a lot of other things. And, you know, so I think there's a lot more work to go. And I'm honestly agnostic right at the moment about whether this bill that the progressive caucus has come forward with would be a good tool for that. It, you know, it might be. And that's something I think folks need to really look at and discuss further. But I don't.
Well,
feel like
actually, I meant the original bill. The one that we used earlier this year, or at least earlier when it first came out, to you know, educate our legislative people and on. I'm thinking around 2010. An earlier bill. I mean, I wouldn't go to them with anything so, you know, detailed. But
I think that there's an overall approach that's great, you know, that's really, really excellent. You know, again, I think that the challenge for all of us is to kind of figure out, you know, how that translates into activity, which I think is the great strength of the Occupy movement, is that they continue to act in a, you know, variety of creative ways. So, I mean, yes.
If I could just say, this is Virginia. Here in Phoenix, we've had our local and the War Coalition has had several activities at Occupy where we see it as an education forum. Right after Veterans Day, we held an event at our Occupy and talked about how, you know, veterans have very high unemployment, how they are definitely part of the 99%, and how the because we spend so much on military, we spend less on even veterans' benefits keep getting cut, and how, you know, we relate to them on that level, and you have to find a subject and take your people's budget that relates to that and educate. We have our PDA meetings every other month at Occupy Phoenix, and we have people that just come and we just do our regular agenda, and it's just we try to make it have at least one educational portion where we can at least, you know, just tell the people what we think. You know, don't tell them you have to agree with us 100%, but at least we're educating them at another viewpoint. And I think that's the big opportunity of Occupy, is that we have people that are going there for all kinds of reasons, and they're communicating with us who have an agenda, some educational points we can share with them. They can take it or they don't have to take it, but we're giving it a shot, and it's a good place to do it.
You know, it's really great. I mean, I think, you know, I'm glad you said that, because I think the whole educational piece is really important. I know here in New York, which is where I am, Code Pink has been particularly, you know, active with the Occupy movement, and they've been doing a lot of cost of war type, you know, educational programming. And you know, actually, for many of the young people participating, you know, in this for the first time, like, had no idea whatsoever of how much is being spent on defense. So, you know, and just some of the basic information about government priorities has come as a great, you know, great talk. So I think there is a, you know, an educational function. I also think it would be great if, and this is something all of our groups should really be doing, is kind of finding ways to share information. In other words, peace groups that are going out to the Occupy movements, you know, and are already interacting in various ways. It would be good to have the benefit of that, you know, of that experience. You know, I think that that's true. But I do think that there is this other piece about, can we begin to develop an action piece that is more than what we've done so far, and which, you know, really takes account of this changed mood that the Occupy people have helped to create.
CJ, Seth? Yes? Go ahead. Hi. So I used to be on the staff of Code Pink and know the organizer that's heavily involved in New York. And I've been involved in Occupy LA as a member of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And I got to say, first of all, not everyone involved in Occupy is young, nor do they need to be educated. A lot of people really already connect the dots between endless war and no money for school teachers, tuition increases. Like, they might not know all the details that you know, but the vast majority of people that I've met in Occupy LA really already have the full picture. Now, the mainstream media might not cover the fact that people know that war is an issue, and that it's not just about the companies that brought about the financial system collapse. But so I think whenever people come to a space where there's a lot of other people, it's actually of any space that I've ever been in, Occupy has forced me to have the most humility, because the horizontal structure of it, which I know a lot of people find difficult to maneuver around, but most Occupies have at least some website that you can go to see at least part of their structure in, it means that people don't care how long you've been in the movement or been an activist or whatnot. They want you to treat them as an equal and not throw around the weight of, you know, well, I've been at this for 10 years, let me tell you how to do it. And there's also already a lot of community organizations that are integrated with the Occupy. And so it's more of a collaborative effort of figuring out what actions to take and whatnot. But I do think that this moment when occupations are moving to another level beyond encampments is a great time. I mean, any time would be a great time for renewed energy into it. But for me, the reason I had to get involved with it was that it's the most number of people engaged in civil discourse that I've ever seen consistently in one place in Los Angeles. And you know, people constantly say how if you're in a place like I am where everyone's cut up by freeways and whatnot, no one's ever going to come to the same place twice. But people have been coming consistently to downtown LA where no one has gathered before for political discourse. And so to actually think about it as the first step being talking to people rather than necessarily coming in with an agenda planned out, I think is a much better way of thinking about engaging with an occupation.
Okay, thanks, CJ. Anybody else? We're running late already. We certainly, Sally and I, are able to stay on longer if anybody wants to stay on longer. Rusty, if you're available, if there's any more questions for you.
I can, you know, stay on just for a few minutes, and I have to sign off.
Okay.
But, you know, people may also have thoughts that they just want to share.
Right. And is Andrea on the line by any chance?